You are listening to the Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, where we discuss myth, math, spirituality, philosophy, and much, much more. www.thesickbook.com. Hey everybody, it's Marty Leeds here. This show is a bonus episode and is a continuation of the conversation that David Matheson and I had on episode 14 of this broadcast. Here is another hour and change for your listening pleasure. Please, if you get the chance, go check out David's blog at mathesoncorollary.blogspot.com, where he has written a few blogs pertaining to our conversation, and he has a bunch of other really great blogs on there as well. So please go check it out if you get the chance. All right, without further ado, this is part two with David Matheson. All right, we are back with David Matheson once again, and we were discussing all sorts of different stuff and just having a really great conversation. So let's one of the things that always comes up with and it's one thing that you actually address in your book, one of the things that always comes up is the question of, so what? You know, what's the big deal? What does all this mean? And maybe we can try to tackle that a little bit.
Right. So thanks for having me back, Marty. We were just getting into, you know, some of these connections to the stars and talking about them in the Greek mythology, and then saying, look, this is actually found in the Bible as well, and this should unite all of us and not divide us. And it also unites us to nature, by the way, because we're connected to the universe. If the stars are reflected in us, then we are intimately connected to nature and the universe. And unfortunately, a lot of the ills in our personal lives and in society seem to be connected to this fact that we're not connected to nature and we're not connected to one another. And so on a very grand level, this has a lot to say to some of the really big issues that we're wrestling with, but it also has issues in our personal life. Because I believe that these stories are not just, oh, gee whiz, you can find constellations connected to this Greek myth. No, they're doing this to convey very profound truths to us that we need. And they're doing it in a really profound and amazing way. So the...
And what is the profundity there? What is so profound?
So it gets into kind of this whole question of the esoteric. The esoteric, a lot of times is understood to mean hidden, but R. A. Schwaller de Lubitsch, who's another author that I think we both have checked out and learned from, says at one point in one of his books, I believe it's called, the name escapes. It's one of his shorter books. It's, something with the word esoteric in it. But he says that these aren't actually just to hide truth. It's actually to get the truth to us that we can't, that our mind would rebel at or choke on any other way. It's a way of conveying it to the mind because the truths, like I said, or like you said, are so profound that we would go, wait a minute, oh, I can't, you know, that's too bizarre. But then when we explain, look, it's like this, well, what can I find that's big enough to explain this concept? How about the stars? I mean, what canvas is bigger than that? The motion of the stars, they rise in the east and they set in the west, just like the sun does, due to the rotation of the earth. So as we're rotating towards the east. That's why New York is 3 hours ahead of California and Oregon, because the east coast gets under the sun's rays first as we're rotating to the east. So that, because of that, everything seems to move west through the sky, including the sun. We all know that the sun pops up on the eastern horizon, then it arcs across the sky as we rotate, and sinks down in the west. And that's because we're speeding towards the east on this spinning globe that we're standing on. Well, as the sun arcs across the sky, it's traveling through not mud, not water, not those lower elements, not the out of the four elements of earth, water, fire, and air. The sun is arcing across the crystal spheres of the sky, the ether. It's arcing through the realms of air and fire. But then, eventually, the turning of the earth is going to cause that sun to crash into the western horizon. And for those of us on the west coast, I always like to say, because I love watching the sun sink into the Pacific Ocean every chance I can, it'll either sink into water, depending on where you're standing, or it'll sink into earth. It's sinking into those lower elements. So the motion of the sun itself can be seen metaphorically to be teaching something about a plunging down out of the realms of spirit and air and plunging down into the realms of earth and water. And that is a profound truth about our human condition. We are like spirit that has been plunged down into a body of earth and water, which is why Adam is depicted as being formed out of clay. And when he's cast out of the Garden of Eden, he is told, you're going to return to the dust from whence you came. You got to return to the soil from whence you came. You got to go back to tilling the soil now. It's going to be hard for you. You see, the constellations that, so the stars do this as well as the sun. They rise in the east and they arc across the sky. And that's like going through the spiritual realms. But Adam and Eve get thrown out of paradise back down into the west. They sink back down into the west. They're thrown out of Eden and they have to toil in the underworld down here in the earth. We're like stars that have been plunged down into matter.
Absolutely true. That's not even a metaphor. That's just we are stars and we have been plunged into matter, right? Yeah.
That's so right. And yet what the ancients, what many of these scriptures seem to describe is a condition where we have forgotten that undeniable fact, where we are in a state of amnesia, where we think we're only material beings, and we've forgotten where we came from. And so sometimes the myths depict it as a maiden or a goddess who, right before the soul incarnates, gives the soul a drink, a cup of wine or something, some mead to make them forget. It's like the mead of forgetting. You forget all your past lives and you even forget that you're a star and you go down into the stupefaction of being in a body where you're a god who's drunk, you're dazed, you're confused, you think you're a human, you think you're an animal. Mm-hmm. You've forgotten, just like in the Odyssey, Medea gives the crew of Odysseus's crew food and drink that's going to turn them into animals. They've forgotten where they came from. They're imprisoned in matter, and that's and so we've forgotten it, and we have to be woken up. And these myths, one aspect of the so what is, hey, don't forget who you are. You have a divine spark inside of you.
Yeah, and I think it's the Myth of Ur. I think it's Plato's Republic, where he talks about they drink from the river of forgetting, or something like that. So that's it's right. Same sort of theme. Yeah,
it's all through all these ancient myths, and I was going to say in the Hindu tradition, they put their hands together in a specific hand gesture or mudra. And they say namaste, which means, I recognize the divinity that's in you. Or sometimes it's translated as, the divinity in me recognizes the divinity in you. Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because it's like reminding, hey, it's easy for us to forget that we have this aspect, this spiritual aspect. It's easy for us to forget there's a whole spiritual world. There's a whole unseen world that we, in this material world, would like to ignore. In fact, there's a whole cadre of scientists who would like to tell us there's no such thing. They're materialists. But the namaste is like they're walking around reminding one another. They're putting their hands together in this position and saying to each other, hey, I remember that you're divine, or the divinity in me recognizes the divinity in you. And what's really, really interesting is that that same hand gesture is in the Christian tradition, what you put your hands together when you're praying and you say, amen, right? Mm-hmm. And what is amen? Well, people like Gerald Massey, who lived in the late 1800s, and Alvin Boyd Kuhn, who was a little bit after Gerald Massey, well, they would say, amen actually relates back to the hidden god of Egypt, Amun. Amun is the hidden god. He's the hidden spark. There's a hidden aspect of divinity that when we're talking about amen, it's the same. Amen and namaste are expressing the same thing. Hidden divinity, and don't forget it. Remind yourself that you are in a physical world, but there's a divine spark in you. And actually, Adam and Eve, when they're thrown out of paradise, are described as being clothed in coats of skin.
Yeah.
they're clothed in coats of skin. That's because they just got incarnated. That's what we are. We came down, metaphorically speaking, from somewhere else into this condition where we've got a coat of skin, and you can reach out and scratch your arm and say, "Yep, there's my coat of skin." So I can show you the constellations that are Adam and Eve and the serpent, by the way. So you can watch them go across the sky and sink down into the west. And at the same time that they're sinking down into the west, an angel is rising on the east to keep them out of Eden. So it works on a celestial level, but they're trying to point to profound truths that should help us in our day-to-day life.
The question I was just about to ask too is that, okay, so we have this story of the fall of man, as you were just explaining, a divine spark of the light of the creator, whatever, falling into this material dimension, almost confounded by it, and then we have this same story being played out in the Zodiac. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Yeah, so that description that I just gave utilized the motion of the earth turning on its axis once a day. We all see the stars, especially the day star, the sun. We see it once a day go through this cycle. So we see it rise up out of the land of material up into the spiritual realm, then we watch it sink down at night. So we see that once a day, but we also see that in the cycle of the earth going around the sun, which, as we were talking about in the previous, has to do with the cycle of the zodiac is a way of tracking our progress around and describing our progress. And each of the signs has characteristics which match up to characteristics of where we are on the year. So the zodiac wheel is simply a depiction of the sun's path through the zodiac. The sun is like our mediator, our intermediary between us and the stars. If you think back to, I think it's a really helpful mental model, the round table in your dining room with the sun in the middle of it in the form of a candle. Let's say you light a candle, put it in the middle of your table, and then you think of this round table, the earth going around the edge of that. The stars are out there on the walls and on the ceiling. And by the way, the North Star is going to be straight up on the ceiling. And depending on where you are on that little ping pong ball, is going to determine the angle that you see the ceiling. But as we go around, the sun is in a different house of the zodiac based on the line that you draw between the earth and the sun, that is the ping pong ball and the candle, and then off to the far wall. So the sun is like the mediator that tells us that we see the stars on the other side that tells us where we are. And it's basically the sunrise. The sun will rise in a different house of the zodiac as we go throughout the year. So in the age of Aries, when the earth was positioned at the spring equinox, the constellation that would be right above the eastern horizon, right before the sun pops up and drowns everything out, was the sign of Aries. It's a little constellation. It's not the easiest to see. But one of the easiest constellations to see is Orion. Almost everybody knows Orion. Orion has the most stars that are bright. The ratio of bright stars to number of stars is the highest in Orion. He's got the most bright stars per outline of any of them. And of course, he's got that wonderful three-star belt. So there's certain parts of the year where you can go out before dawn and see Orion in all his glory in the east. And he's not actually a zodiac sign. He's underneath Taurus. And Taurus is over his head. The V-shaped Hyades of Taurus is right over his head. And that's why people like Samson and other heroes around the world sometimes wield a V-shaped weapon that is a jawbone-shaped weapon. Samson kills a whole bunch of enemy with a jawbone of a donkey. And the jawbone of a donkey is actually the V of Taurus, the Hyades, right over his head. But anyway, in the morning you can see Orion even before the sun comes up. But if you stare at the sky after a while, as the sun starts to approach or as the earth turns towards the sunrise, the eastern sky will start to get lighter and lighter blue. Even when the west is still pitch black sky, the east will start to be lighter and lighter, and then it'll turn this beautiful color blue, and you can still see Orion because he's so bright in the blue. And I'd recommend everyone do this during the time of year when Orion is there in the light blue sky, and the sky gets lighter and lighter, and eventually, boom, the sun comes up and you can't see Orion at all anymore. But that would be the sun rising in the house of Taurus in this case. But as we go through the year, in the age of Aries, that would happen in the constellation Aries when we get to the spring equinox, which is a distinctive part of the cross of the year. We got to get to that because that's really important. The cross of the year has two equinoxes and two solstices. And then as we proceed along through the zodiac, because the little ping pong ball, it's spinning each day, but it's actually moving around the table. As we all know, the Earth, we have years. So as the Earth in its orbit moves along, the stars, it actually causes the stars to rise about 4 minutes earlier each day. So that means the constellations are going to get a little further along each day. Because why is that happening? It's because the ping pong ball is making progress. Mm-hmm. So as we make progress, we're passing the stars on the walls. If you think of the stars on the wall as being like posters, like maybe they're rock concert posters. So you've got, Van Halen on one wall and you've got Led Zeppelin on another wall or whatever.
That's an awesome zodiac, by the way.
Yeah, we got Bob Marley. We want Bob Marley on there, of course. And, Peter Tosh. So all your favorites. And you got to have one woman on there for Virgo, too. So, your favorite, poster. And as we get through the year, there's going to be a different poster is going to be the background for the sunrise, and a different poster will be in the middle of the sky at midnight. Because, by the way, when the ping pong balls turn totally away from the middle of the table, you can stare out into the middle of the sky and you'll be like, oh, wow, look, Bob Marley's right in the middle of the sky at midnight. But at a different part of the year, you won't be able to see the poster of Bob Marley at all. Why? Because the sun will be in the way. Bob Marley will be on the opposite side of the wall from the candle, and you can't see the constellations during the day. Yeah, Bob Marley's up there, but it's noon, so forget it. You can't see him. So that's what happens as we go through the year, and that's the zodiac. So as we go through the year, you're going to have a time when the sun rises in Aries, and in the age of Aries, that was at the spring equinox. Precession has delayed that now. So now Pisces is actually there at the spring equinox, but actually Pisces is already, it's being delayed by the motion of precession, which in myth is metaphorized as being held down, sometimes even drowned, drowned under the water. See, Set drowns his brother Osiris. Actually, he cuts him up. He nails him into a coffin. I mean, Set is a bad dude, but he usurps his brother Osiris and he casts him into the ocean. So he's holding down Orion. Osiris was associated with Orion. But anyway, stop me before I go off on a tangent. But anyway, as we go around the sky, as we go around on this orbit, we're going to have Aries, then Taurus, then Gemini. And after going through those 3 months, after the spring equinox, we're now at the gateway of midsummer. Midsummer day, you know, in The Hobbit, they've got to, you know, to get into the to get into Smaug's Mountain there. It's got to be on Midsummer's Day. The thrush has to be knocking. Okay, well, we've gotten to Midsummer's Day 3 months after spring equinox. We're going to get to June 21st, which is the summer solstice. It's going to be right after the sign of Gemini and right before the sign of Cancer the Crab. And this is really important because it relates to so much, you know, of the so what. It relates to the high point of the year. We could draw a line from the high point of the year to the low point of the year, and that's going to be a vertical line on our zodiac wheel. So if you envision the zodiac wheel as a big circle,
which, by the way, makes pi.
Yes. I mean, I was so excited by your THC interview. It was so great. Yeah. I mean, it's infinite, but it's crossed. So here we are. We're crossed on this cross of matter. We can get into that. So let's make this big circle, and then let's draw a vertical line right through it. And we'll call the highest point on the circle that vertical line intersects, we'll call that the summer solstice. And the lowest point on that circle, we'll call that the winter solstice. And now let's draw a horizontal line, and we're going to call that the line of the equinoxes, because that's where the sun crosses over from having shorter days to having longer days. So that's the horizontal line. So now we've drawn this circle with a cross through it. It's the sacred hoop of the Lakota. It's, if you got a tattoo of a circle with a cross through it, somebody in the checkout line might say, "Oh, are you a pagan?" That's a pagan symbol. Well, it's the year. It's a lot more than that. It's everything that we're supposed to be doing in this incarnation. So we'll get into that. So the horizontal line, that's where we start with Aries, and then as we're moving up from that horizontal line on the left, we get to Taurus, then we get to Gemini, and now we're almost at the vertical line, because Gemini is the house right before the summer solstice. And then as we will hit June 21st and cross over the summer solstice, the very highest point of the year, and now the sun's going to begin to decline back down towards winter because we've passed midsummer. Then we'll enter the house of Cancer. This is as we go through the year. This is going to be the month of the end of June and then the first two-thirds of July. Then we're going to hit the August, is Leo the Lion at the end of July. And the first two-thirds of August is going to be Leo the Lion. Then we're going to hit Virgo. So Virgo, as we go through the year, Virgo is the sign that's after the Lion. But as we go through the night, see, sometimes I've gotten this a little confused. As we go through the night, the constellation Virgo actually follows the Lion, okay? And that's important because ancient goddesses are often associated with lions. They'll be in chariots drawn by lions. They'll be in thrones flanked, you know, sitting on a throne like a queen, flanked by a lion.
Inanna stands on two lions.
Absolutely. The Ishtar Gate has lions in Babylon, right? The great goddess, Sibeli, or, you know, lots of these ancient queen of heaven, celestial goddess, is enthroned with a lion right next to her. That's because Virgo follows Leo. And in fact, even in ancient Egypt, we can see artwork where she is standing on the back of a lion and holding a serpent in one hand, which, by the way, there's a serpent right next to the constellation Hydra is right next to Virgo. So anyway, Hydra, yeah, absolutely. So that we're still going through the year, so you're asking me to describe the zodiac wheel. So as we go through the wheel, so Virgo is right there as we're about to cross over back down into the lower half of the year. If you followed us, and there's lots of diagrams of this on my blog. I have this zodiac wheel a lot, and of course it's in the book quite a few times. So Virgo stands right there at the gateway at the end of the upper half of the year, right before we cross back over into the days being shorter than nights again. Oh, bummer. You know, I can't go surfing as early because it's still pitch black out. Oh, bummer. You know, I'm walking to school in the dark as a fifth grader and we got to have daylight savings. Oh, bummer. You know, when I come home from work at night, it's already pitch. It's been dark since 4:30. I don't like it. And that's the lower half of the year. Well, that half is incarnation. That's why when we sink down into incarnation, there's a goddess right there. Virgo is associated with incarnating you. Eve is associated with the fall. Sure. And the constellation Virgo, by the way, has this distinctive outstretched arm marked by the star Vindamiatrix, which in Latin means the fruit plucking or the grape plucking star. She reaches out to, that's why Eve is the one who takes the fruit, because she's got this outstretched arm. And there's a constellation right over her called Boötes, the herdsman. That's her husband, Adam. And she's holding out this arm right towards Adam. That's why she's the one who gives the fruit to Adam. And yet, if you take this literally, as you know, through the centuries, people have said, aha, women are evil. Aha, if men listen to their wives, they'll be led astray. All based on Adam and Eve and taking it literally, when the reason the story is like that is because of where Virgo is on the year and how the stars of the constellation Virgo seem to be reaching out to pluck the fruit and then seem to be reaching out to offer the fruit. And that's what it's encoding. It's not, you're not supposed to take from this that women are the root of all evil, and yet literally that's how it's been taken. It's been used to divide the sexes instead of all these things should unite us. You see what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you see it that way, if we're all children of Adam and Eve, and then you realize Adam and Eve are actually constellations, then that should, that's profound. Okay. Well, they're stars and we're all children of stars.
Yeah.
And by the way, then we don't have to get hung up over whether, well, did Adam have, brown hair or blonde hair? You know, what color was Adam's hair? I don't like all these pictures of Adam because, you know, they don't look like me. Well, Adam's a constellation. You know, you're getting caught up in the wrong things. You're getting caught up in the material when it's supposed to be pointing you to a spiritual truth. And yet, those things have been used to divide mankind when taken literally. Like they have been used to say, oh yeah, Adam and Eve were once this, you know, they were this color skin, but then the mark of Cain marked all these people with this color skin. I mean, it's racist, right? But it's been used that way. I'm not saying that people still use it that way, but when taken literally, these things can tend to divide people. Oh, I'm descended from Abraham and you're not.
Yeah.
But wait a minute, Abraham can be shown to be a constellation. Noah can be shown to be a constellation, and so can his three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. They are constellations, so nobody's literally descended from them, and yet that has been used to divide people. And so, like you said earlier, I believe that these are a precious treasure that were given to all of humanity that show up all around the world and should actually, if understood properly, unite us, but unfortunately have been used to divide us.
You know, even... Why, I mean, even though that these, you know, looking at it like this, it seems pretty, it's, you know, kind of cut and dry in one respect. You know, it's like, okay, we can understand that we're talking about astrological cycles. At the same time, it's like the Bible, at least in one respect, if it is an astrotheological document, which of course it is in one respect, why are the references so cryptic? This is a question I always get. It's like, okay, well, if this was, why didn't somebody just come out and say, hey, that's Hydra, snake, and that's Gemini there, and that and just write the story that way? Why is it always couched in symbolic metaphor, that sort of thing?
Great question. And the answer is, since I wasn't there to...
I ain't got a clue.
At the writing these... I don't know, yeah, right? Yeah. I can only speculate, but it's a huge, important question, so let's deal with that. Because people can be forgiven, right, for taking these literally. I mean, I took this literally for 20 years of my adult life, because the stories don't say, now here's a metaphor about Samson. Samson is really a constellation, but now let's talk about him as if he's a man on earth going to see a beautiful woman, which, by the way, is Virgo. going down the hill to see Virgo. They don't say that. They say Samson lived in such and such a city and fell in love with such and such a woman and had these adventures. They don't tell you that. And even in the parables of Jesus, he says, well, these things are given in parables so that people can be always hearing and not understanding.
Sure.
And then his disciples will come to him and say, well, I'll tell you, but this isn't for the masses. And even Samson is a great, and I've laid out the Samson myth in other interviews, and also the first three chapters of my book are online. You can read those for free. They're right there on my website. I talk about the Samson myth. But Samson poses this as a riddle. He, on his way down to meet the beautiful woman, which is Virgo, he encounters a lion. We just said Leo and Virgo are right next to each other. So he kills the lion with his bare hands, and the next time he comes around, which might be a year later if he's the sun, with his seven locks of hair, there's your number seven again, but on this circle, there's your pie, right? When Samson comes around again, the lion's carcass now has bees in it. And Samson says, ah, this is a great riddle. I'm going to pose this as a riddle, and if anyone can answer it, I'll give them a reward. But if they can't answer it, they'll have to give me a reward. So he poses it as a riddle. He says, he's basically begging you to think about it as if it has a hidden meaning, as a riddle. Mm-hmm. So why would they do this? Why is it only for the initiated, right? Well, for one thing, this is a way of passing it on. This could be a way of passing it on for generations. If some king wants to stamp it out back in the days before mass publishing of paperback books, all you would have to do is kill all the wise men and the knowledge is gone. But if you put it in beautiful stories that people just can't help but tell to their kids around the fire, and then they get turned into folk tales too, because this also operates not just on the level of high sacred myth, but also in folk tales like Cinderella and all these other folk tales as well, and also the Arabian Nights. I was rereading the Arabian Nights and I was going, oh my goodness, here it is in the Arabian Nights, and I've got a blog post about that. The Arabian Nights, what a bunch of stories. They're so amazing. We turn them into Disney movies. But anyway, the big question is, why would they do that? One is possibly to preserve it. I believe it's because, and I use the metaphor, and apologies to those who have heard it before, but it's like Daniel-san and Mr. Miyagi in The Karate Kid. This is the way to teach deep, hard to swallow, hard to grasp concepts, is you have to clothe them in something else. You have to bring them down to the material world. And Daniel-san is not told at first, hey, wax these cars because this is going to teach you how to do karate. He's not told that. He's told, wax these cars.
Sure.
And that's all he does. Why? Because Mr. Miyagi's a jerk? Because he wants to trick Daniel-san? Because he wants to hide it from the... No. None of those things. He knows Daniel-san needs this, but he also knows that if he sits Daniel-san down and says, now listen, Daniel-san, I've been in a lot of fights. I know fighting. You just got to believe me when I say that if you do this hand motion, it will actually stop one of Johnny's kicks. Have you felt Johnny's kicks? Daniel-san rubs his jaw and says, yes, I have felt his kicks. He's spinning his whole body around. He's swinging that leg at me like swinging a log on the end of a chain. And when it hits, it's like a thunderclap. I've felt it. And then Mr. Miyagi says, yeah, but if you hold your arm at this angle, it'll stop that leg. Daniel-san's brain is going to go. Left brain's going to kick in and go, what angle was that? Wait, can I write that down? Hold on, let me analyze that angle. Wait a minute, I'm not even really sure that I believe this. Can that really stop that leg? I don't know. His brain's going to get in. It's going to be this forest of questions popping up in Daniel-san's left brain. But instead, Mr. Miyagi says, Daniel-san, wax this car all day long, and then wax this one, and then wax it. And Daniel-san goes, okay, I promised to do whatever he said, so okay, here I go. And he's daydreaming. His left brain has been put to sleep. He's just waxing cars. He's down in the material world. He's not in the spiritual world at all. Why? Because Mr. Miyagi had to get all that out of the way. Then later he's going to show him what it means. There's another metaphor, Montessori. Have you ever heard of Montessori?
No.
Yeah, you would love Montessori. So Montessori is, my mom's a Montessori teacher. She has a Montessori school. She's had Montessori school since I was a kid. I went to Montessori. Montessori teaches children mathematical concepts using physical models, like number rods painted red and blue. And if you've got a number rod with 7 segments alternating red and blue, and you line it up next to a number rod with 5 segments alternating red and blue, you're going to see immediately that there's a difference of 2 between the 7 rod and the 5 rod. And you go, oh, that's a difference. That's right. If you subtract 5 from 2, you'll get a difference. That's what we actually call the result of a subtraction operation. We call it a difference.
Yeah.
And they show it. They've even got, they've got little beads, number beads, in groups, groupings of 5, but in a long chain, to where you can wind the chain like a serpent and turn the beads into a little square. Well, that's the square of 5, and it's a square, and it's got 25 in it. See, they're showing them how to square a number by making it turn into a square. It was invented by a woman named Maria Montessori, who lived in Italy, and was the first Italian woman to be allowed to get a PhD. I mean, it was like back in the late 1800s when women did not have a lot of educational opportunities to go to all the way to the PhD level. So she's Dr. Maria Montessori, and she said, hey, I've got all these ideas on how to teach children. And they said, yeah, you know, what do you know? You're a woman. We'll let you teach these kids. And she did, and it worked so well. They said, okay, we'll let you teach whoever you want. And anyway, so Montessori does that. They've even got a binomial cube, this is where I was driving to, and a trinomial cube, where they actually have a little model, a little toy that a kid can learn to play with that represents all the variables in a trinomial or a binomial being squared or cubed. And children get to play with this from the age of 3, 4, and 5, and it's not too much longer, but they don't introduce it right away as, hey, this is actually a complex algebraic operation. They introduce it as, hey, let's see if you can put this thing together where the blue matches up with the blue and the red with the red. But not much longer later, like in third grade, they'll say, now I'm going to teach you how to square a binomial, square a trinomial. And most people don't learn this until high school. In Montessori, they introduce it to the child because it's already a familiar friend to the child. Mm-hmm. And then they pull out the cube and they say, remember this cube? I didn't tell you what it meant back then, but actually, you're squaring a binomial. You already know how to square a binomial. Here it is. And then the light comes on in their brain. They go, wow, I see it. And that's, I think, what these esoteric things are doing. So they're using these amazing Montessori materials of the stars or of numbers or of geometric designs. That's your specialty, right? You found them doing this with numbers. Mm-hmm. You found them doing this with Vesica Pisces or whatever. I've discovered them doing it with the stars. I'm not the discoverer of this. Like I said, people like Plato, Lucian of Samosata was talking about this. Hamlet's Mill authors were talking about this. Alvin Boyd Kuhn was talking about this. But they were doing it with the stars. They were putting it, so they weren't just teaching mathematical properties either with these stars. They were teaching spiritual truths or things about our existence or things about the universe. They were saying, listen, the universe is constructed like this. And by the way, now here in the 20th century and 21st century, the physicists have come around to putting together models of the universe that are holographic that match up with what these models were teaching. So your question, why would they do it like this? But why would they keep it a secret? I don't know. And some people might want to say, hey, Matheson, why are you giving away all these secrets? You know, didn't Jesus say this is just for the initiated? Let's give the, don't cast your pearls before the swine. Let's sure. keep these things secret for the few. And I would say, you know, actually, I'm somewhat sympathetic to that, except for the fact that the people who kept it secret then used it to teach literalism. You know, we've got people going to church being told their whole life, all the way from until they're 60, 70, and 80 years old, that this is all about literalism, and don't take it metaphorically, geometrically, or astronomically. They're being told their whole life that this is all about human figures crossing a Red Sea, and that's deception. Here's people going to the people who should be teaching the scriptures and asking, and they're being told. Now I think
a perverted story of it. That sucks out all the wonder, right?
Well, I mean, there's still a lot of wonder. Look, there's still a lot. I don't think even the sucked out version or the counterfeit version, we might say, would be as compelling as it was. It's still compelling. It still gives a lot of value to people's lives. So that means that the full thing must just be profound. If the truncated version still gives so much meaning to people, right? But and I'll also say, I don't think that every single teacher of the Bible is deliberately deceiving someone. I think a whole lot of people,
sure,
right? But at some point in history, there were people who did know this and deliberately told just the layer one, and deliberately hid and even stamped out the teachers who were teaching the other layers, and then used that literalism to go around and start stamping out the Gnostics, and then they started stamping out the Celtic Druids. They started stamping out the Germanic Norse, you know, cutting down their sacred groves and trees and converting them at the point of the sword to literalist Christianity, as Charlemagne did. You know, even his contemporary chroniclers that he hired to write down what he was doing, right? He said, look, you're going to be the historian. They say this is what he did. You know, he lined them all up and said, you want to be baptized? You want to have your head cut off? Okay. So there might be some valid reasons for keeping this secret and making people kind of struggle towards it, and then, you know, struggle with the binomial cube and then tell them. But somewhere along the line, they stopped telling the kids that the binomial cube, actually, they stopped teaching how it relates to a binomial, and they said it's just about a cube. And they stopped teaching Daniel-san, hey, this is actually about a kung fu system or a karate system. It's just about waxing the car. Mm-hmm. And that's wrong. If people are coming to you to learn karate and you only teach them waxing the car, and they say, okay, well, doesn't this relate to karate? And they say, nope, just waxing the car. When it really does, that's deceitful. And then if they, as the ones who know the karate and the kung fu, then use their karate to go around beating other people up with violence, as happened with literalist Christianity, going out and stamping out. First they stamped out in Europe, then they started going across the ocean and stamping out the shamanic cultures of the Americas and burning the sacred Maya texts and taking children away from their parents and putting them in schools where they were not allowed to speak the native languages and only allowed to speak English and only taught Christianity and don't believe all those heathen pagan belief. At that point, you know, it's like, look, even if there was a reason to keep this stuff secret, the people who are keeping it secret are abusing it. Mm-hmm. So I am sympathetic to that idea of, hey, you know, these are certain things that you shouldn't learn right away, kind of like the kid with the binomial cube or Daniel-san with the wax on wax. But at some point, you got to teach them the kung fu or the binomial and the uplifting side of it. If you only use it as a tool to beat people down and keep them in submission, then you can't very well argue that you want to keep it secret.
You know, I'm really glad you're saying this, because this is something that I've fought with for a little while. Like, you know, when I started stumbling upon a lot of this information, it was like, okay, well, do I just keep this for myself, or do I, you know, give this away? When you have all of these, especially, you know, people like, you know, St. Augustine and St. Bernard of Clairvaux saying basically, hey, if you are initiated, don't give this away because it has to be earned, kind of thing. But I felt the exact same way. It's like, okay, except they, you're no longer getting the degree. The people that are holding the information are actually leading you astray. And so therefore, the only way to really kind of fight back is to really put this out into the open. And I feel like right now, even what we're doing right now, the internet has provided us that opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really kind of important subject, and I don't think I've ever gotten into kind of this kind of stuff in any other interviews. But see, I never was initiated in it. You know, I learned this from the Book of the Stars and from reading the Bible. And by the way, you know, there was a lot of centuries where you weren't allowed to have the Bible, probably because if if you let everybody read it for long enough and study it, they might start to see that it matches up with the stars. But I was never initiated, so I'm not giving away something that I was taught and told not to tell anybody. And I don't know about you,
just to clarify, me neither. I mean, I learned this myself by reading a lot of the same authors as you, so just to clarify that.
But then the question is, well, whose information is this? You know, if you say, well, we get to decide who gets to know it or not, then you're implying that this stuff belongs to a certain group. It's like, who has the right to keep... I think the stars belong to all mankind.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I should say humanity, right? Not some people think mankind is just talking about men. So this is the precious inheritance of humanity. This is the precious inheritance of all peoples across the world. And yet we still have people running around the globe saying, your shamanic culture needs to be brought up to date. You know, get with the program here. We've got some Christian missionaries who are going to, because our spirit is more powerful than your spirits. You're saying that, you know, I don't even want to go down that tangent. What I'm saying is, these aren't somebody's secret to decide who gets to know it and who doesn't. I believe they belong to everybody. I don't think they should be misused. I don't think they should be treated, denigrated or trampled in the mud. And that is that's a concern that people might say, if you just lay it out there. But frankly, I don't think the whole world is beating down their door, beating down my door to learn this stuff. You know, it's not everybody who tunes in to the Marty Leeds podcast. It's the people who are looking for this stuff.
Though they should.
Right. See, everybody. But it's not like, putting this out, it's not like every single person is more interested in this than in, I don't know, Monday Night Football. Not that there's anything wrong with football. But there's certain people who are hungering for this stuff.
Yeah.
Should they be told, there is no karate, just keep waxing the car? No.
Yeah.
They're honestly looking for this stuff. And I think it belongs to all of humanity, and I think it's egregious how it's been used to divide humanity, and it's still used to divide humanity. And in fact, I think it's actually connected to a lot of other things that are going on. In other words, the people who know this kung fu system, they know that there actually is something to where the planet Jupiter happens to be in relation to the Earth right about now. And so they're using the kung fu system in a bad way to beat people up. There's an awful lot of strange connections to, 9/11 happened to take place when Mars was in the sting of the scorpion. I mean, there's all kinds of these types of things where you go, whoa, who's so obsessed with the astronomy of all this? What's going on here? Somebody still knows this ancient system, is what I'm saying.
Okay, this is a really important question here, because if there is some sort of like organized network of people that's behind the scenes making the moves to make sure that the history gets buried, myths turned literal, this sort of thing, like who is it? Who are these people? Like, I mean, because from my own investigation, it seems to me that it's rather like ridiculous to point to any one group, whether that's like the Vatican or the Illuminati or the Zionists with Bilderbergers, but at the same time, it's not to say that there isn't a group that's doing it. So it comes back to this question, like who are these people?
Yeah. Well,
and I don't know if there's an answer for that, but
yeah, this is, so this kind of gets into part three of like what happened to it. And I would say, as you've expressed in some of your, some of the things that you've said, I keep referring to that THC interview, but that's because I listened to it twice as I was getting ready to talk to you. You said, some people will see a coincidence and think, oh my goodness, it's these all-powerful people are, making this happen or making that, it's the Illuminati did put this here, when it's like, well, hold on, are they in control of how far away the moon is from the Earth? I don't think so. So, this is a big question, bigger than I've got evidence to lay out. So, What I will say is there's some specific evidence in history that at the time of the, and I go into this in, you know, the part of the book that you haven't got to, part three is all about how the literalists stamped out kind of what I'm broadly calling the Gnostic. We can use that term. Gnostic has some very specific meanings, but broadly, Gnostic approach to Christianity was deliberately stamped out in the first three centuries AD. And there's an author named Flavio Barbiero who has this theory related to the rise of a certain group of families that actually took over the Roman Empire from the inside and then used the Roman Empire and threw it away, kind of like the husk, you know, threw it away and then had Western Europe under their control and continued on from there. And you know, at this point, some listeners may be going, whoa, you know, you just lost me there. That's just, you know, that's too much. But really, where has the understanding of the shamanic and the spirit and the where has that been stamped out? It was stamped out in the places that the Roman Empire, and specifically really the Western Roman Empire, got to.
Within a few centuries of Christianity being founded or established, we already had a manipulation of it, a perversion of it happening, basically, right?
So this is actually what I believe is, well, what I believe there's a lot of evidence for. I'm always open to changing. You know, I've had to change my opinion, my whole paradigm, when I realized that the Bible wasn't literal. You know, between my first book and my second book, I've gone through, you know, pretty big kind of, hey, I'm changing, I was wrong, in some ways. You know, I was in the right track in some ways. I was on the wrong track in some other ways. You know, so I'm still open to additional evidence, but there is evidence for what you just described happening in the time of Vespasian and Titus. There was there was trouble in Judea. There were people that were not happy with the Roman occupation in Judea, and a couple of generals were sent out during the reign of Nero to quell the rebellion. And by the way, the Judeans were good warriors and they were fighters, and the priests were also warriors. They were warrior priests. And the two generals that were sent out there was a father-son team. It was Flavius Titus Vespasian and his son, whose name was also Flavius Titus Vespasian. But one's referred to as Vespasian, that's the dad, and one's referred to as Titus, that's the son. They were both generals, and they went into Judea to crush this uprising. And we learn about it in great detail in the writings of someone named Josephus. And Josephus isn't just any ordinary guy. Josephus, he makes it very clear in his writings, was one of the priestly class who was fighting against Vespasian. He was actually in charge of the region of Galilee. And in comes the first blow of the hammer to come out of Mordor, so to speak, fell in Galilee. When Rome sent the legions in, Josephus was right there on the front lines, and he eventually got basically had to retreat into the fortress of Jotapata, or today you can find it on Wikipedia under the name Yodfat. But they were besieged, and basically it was pretty much they were surrounded, and it was like, you know, like Helm's Deep, except now the orcs are breaking through. And Josephus and his fellow warriors looked at each other and said, I think we're done for here. They had retreated all the way down into the cistern, according to Josephus's account that he published afterwards. This is in the period 66 AD, AD 66 through the fall of the temple at Jerusalem was AD, do you know, AD 70. So the first blow, the first hammer fell in Galilee. He had retreated all the way down into the cistern. he says, underneath the, you know, the water supply for the city. They were standing basically waist deep in water, him and his remaining warriors, and they said, hey, let's all kill each other instead of giving up to these Romans, you know, because we're hardcore. And so they drew straws and decided to run each other through, except at the last moment, Josephus, who had kind of drawn one of the last straws, this is what he puts in his writings, at the last minute after everybody but him and one other guy had killed themselves, he said, you know what? I've got a change of heart. Let's not kill ourselves. God has obviously sided with the Romans here for some reason. I don't know why. But I think we can serve him better alive than dead. Let's go out and see if we can talk to this general. And this is what he puts in his thing. And he said, I went and I spoke to Vespasian, and I told him that my God had spoken to me and told him that he was going to be emperor. I asked for an audience with the general. The soldiers took me to him for whatever reason. We have to, that's a question mark in his account. So it's obviously he's telling the story. So it's, there may be some self-servingness in the way he's, you know, the details that he might leave out. But anyway, he went to the general. He told him, hey, my God has told me that you're going to be emperor. And because of that, supposedly, Vespasian spares his life, rewards him with lots of honors, and eventually Vespasian did become the emperor, and he actually brought Josephus back to Rome and gave Josephus his old villa. When Vespasian became the emperor, he built himself a new palatial residence, and he said, hey, Josephus, you remember that prophecy? I'm going to give you my house because I like you so much. Now, this is in Josephus. You can see it. And Flavio Barbiero, who's an author who's written a book called The Secret Society of Moses and the Conspiracy Lasting Three Millennia, says something doesn't ring completely true here in this narrative. Why would Vespasian spare the guy's life in the first place, but not only that, give him all these honors? Not only that, he gave him a signet ring, gave him a robe, gave him a female prisoner that he that Josephus favored to be his wife, which, by the way, Josephus was already married. He divorced his other wife and got this, you know, young prisoner from Judea. So all these things don't ring true to Barbiero, and he says, I think something more may have gone on in that little meeting with Josephus. I'm making a long story really long, but it's important for your question of what happened.
Sure.
Because what Flavio Barbiero says is Josephus was a member of the priestly class. He had grown up in Judea. He was a warrior. He was a priest. He knew this system of the ancient, you know, the Old Testament's all built on all these things. If anybody knew it in that culture, if anybody knew the secrets, it would have been the priestly class, right?
Mm-hmm.
All these Old Testament things that we were just talking about are there. Okay, so what may have Josephus have said to Vespasian? How about something like this? You know, Vespasian, or even to the soldier. So the soldier even, you know, why would the soldier have even taken him to the general in the first place? Maybe he said to the soldier, listen, I've got a lot of treasure. I've got a lot of money. Your general really, really wants to talk with me. And the soldier might have said, well, you know what? I feel like just running you through, but just so I don't get in trouble, let me go check with him. And Vespasian said, bring him to me. And so this may be what happened. He might have said to Vespasian, listen, I've got a lot of money right here in Galilee region, and I'll give that to you. But I also know where the treasure of the temple is hidden. The temple of Jerusalem, I can get you that treasure. So if you keep me alive, it'll be worth it to you. And Vespasian might have said, I'm still listening. And then Josephus might have made good on his promise and gotten him the treasure of the temple. Because as Flavio Barbiero points out, the triumph of Vespasian and Titus, when they came back to Rome triumphant, they were given a triumph, and in the triumph were all the treasures of the Temple of Jerusalem, and you can even see them depicted on the Arch of Titus. There's an Arch of Titus that's still standing, and it shows the treasure. So they got the treasures. How did they get them? Well, Josephus says, well, some traitor priests kind of lowered it over the wall when nobody else was looking in the middle of the night, and that's how these traitor priests gave the treasure over to the Romans. That might be a self-serving cover-up by Josephus, because as Barbiero points out, that doesn't ring true. The defenders at the temple were diehard, battle-hardened, zealot, very dedicated. They were not going to give the treasure over to the Romans. And if they saw somebody doing it, they would have stopped them. They would have probably killed them. And they weren't like all asleep at night. So how did these things get? They even burned down the temple. They tried to burn down the temple before the when they got to the point where they saw that all hope was gone. They said, "Hey, let's not let this fall into the Roman hands. Let's burn down the temple." And Barbiero says, "I don't even think that the treasure was still in the temple at that point. It would have been kind of stupid for it to still be in the temple just in case they lost. They buried it all over the place in hidden spots, and they had a special scroll inscribed on copper so it couldn't catch fire, so it couldn't get water damage, that told where all the treasure was." And the reason that's important is because there were these things called the Dead Sea Scrolls that were discovered after World War II in the Dead Sea, where there's all these scrolls, and one of the scrolls is a copper scroll, and it's really different from all the rest because it says things like, "In the graveyard at a depth of 6 feet, 42 bars of gold. Next to the tamarisk tree that's over by the such and such well, at a depth of 30 feet, such and such amount of silver." And when the Dead Sea Scrolls were uncovered, there was one scholar named John M. Allegro. You may have heard of him from other things that he talks about, including mushrooms.
Sure.
John M. Allegro was one of the, he was a Qumranist. They were found at a place called Qumran. He was a scholar, and he was one of the people who looked at these and said, "I think this copper scroll here is a treasure map." And he tried to find all the treasure, but he never found any of it. The reason being is the last line on the copper scroll says, "And by the way, there's a copy of this scroll in such and such a place." Well, Josephus probably went and got that copy of the scroll, and then with little groups of Roman soldiers in the middle of the night went to these various places and got all the treasure secretly and got it for Vespasian. And that's why none of the treasure's ever been found, because it was given to Vespasian, and that's how Vespasian and Titus became the emperors, because after the time of the Caesars, the Julian dynasty ended with Nero. Nero committed suicide. There were some generals that were starting to rebel, and you know, Nero was so crazy that some of the generals started to say, this guy's off his rocker. Why don't you, the soldiers were like, "Why don't you become the emperor?" And there was this big power struggle going on where one general after another in this year of four emperors was becoming emperor, and you had to have enough money to pay your troops if you wanted to be a contender in this big game of capture the throne. And Vespasian had got the money from that enabled him to become the emperor, and that's why he gave his old villa to Josephus, and that's why Josephus was allowed to pick any new wife that he wanted, and that's why Josephus was able to save when Titus and Vespasian said, "Look, we're gonna start killing all the leaders of this, but if you want to pick out some people to save, go ahead." And Josephus saved a whole bunch of other members of the priestly lines, and they all went back to Rome. They sure weren't gonna stay in Judea because they just betrayed their countrymen and to these Romans. But they could go disappear and start a whole new life in Rome. And there's the shift from Jerusalem to Rome. And so now, according to Barbiero's theory, you've got a whole bunch of very intelligent priests, who are also warrior priests, by the way, who know this ancient system. They know how to run a religion. They know how to run. They may even know the Kung Fu system that's beyond the motions of wax on, wax off. They may know stuff about the whole spirit realm. But in any event, they're totally in a new place, and they're like, "What are we going to do?" "I know. Let's rebuild the temple." "What?" "Yeah. Let's rebuild an invisible temple right here in Rome. Let's rebuild a spiritual temple. Let's create... Let's take over the Roman Empire." And you might go, "That's crazy." But Barbiero shows a lot of evidence that they just might have actually done it. And it took them about 300 years to maneuver their guys into position. And actually, Commodus might have been one of the first ones that they actually maneuvered into the position of emperor. You remember in the movie Gladiator, there's the old Marcus Aurelius, who was not a big friend of the Christians, and he wants to make Russell Crowe the emperor instead of his crazy son Commodus. Mm-hmm. And Commodus is like, well, I don't like that very much. I think I'll kill Marcus Aurelius, my dad, who's just about to disinherit me, and then I'll kill Russell Crowe too, because I'm mad. And Commodus might have been a real turning point, but it was kind of like fits and starts through the years until they finally got Constantine in there, and he, and by that point, the descendants of these priestly lines that came from Judea had control of the Roman Empire. That's, it seems like a stretch. There's a whole lot of stepping stones of evidence along the way, but that's when there was already Christianity going on, but it might have been Gnostic Christianity. That's when all of a sudden we start to see, not too long after Josephus and his friends arrive in Rome, we start seeing Christian bishops writing letters that say, hey, all you churches are below us, or you better take, we're going to be in charge now.
The hierarchy was established, right?
The hierarchy starts getting put in place, and these texts are going to be okay, and those texts, if you get caught with those, it's going to be curtains for you. And that's when some of these other texts that didn't make it into the canon start getting burned and destroyed. And some of them got buried at a place called Nag Hammadi because some people just couldn't bear to get rid of them, apparently. And they were buried, and those were found. Those are a completely different set of texts that were found in the 20th century called the Nag Hammadi texts, which are much more Gnostic but Christian, or Valentinian or Sethian. There's some distinctions within, you can get technical about this, but there's some evidence, there's a lot of evidence that this actually happened. And I'll just throw one more important piece into the puzzle, and that is, these guys didn't just invent Christianity, because I don't think they invented Christianity. I think there was already something there that they said, hey, wait a minute, let's make this literalist, because what Christianity is actually related to ancient Egypt, ancient mysteries. And there might have been a guy named Paul who was a priest. He makes it quite clear in his writings. Hey, I was a priest. I was a Pharisee. I went to basically the Harvard of the ancient scriptures. I am well trained in this stuff. And he actually started, apparently, perhaps, according to a theory by Gerald Massey, introducing people to the real mysteries that he wasn't supposed to do. The Osirian mysteries, that's why Christianity mirrors this stuff so much, is because Paul was giving away what these priests were like aghast. They were like, how come he's saying that? Let's get rid of that dude, and we can't get the cat back all the way back into the bag. The cat's out of the bag. Let's just tell everybody it's all literal, and it's not, these mysteries that we wanted to keep secret, that Paul let out. So, but they also created another vehicle, a secret vehicle that met in secret, and it was the Society of Mithras. And you actually see that in some of these movies like Gladiator or The Eagle, where they depict the soldiers are always, following this cult of Mithras. Mithras, according to the theory of Flavio Barbiero, was a secret. They didn't just create literalist Christianity. They had a much more secret, that was like the inner circle. The Society of Mithras was actually behind the scenes controlling things, so that when the emperors and the Senate wanted to fight back against this takeover, they directed all their anger against Christianity. That was the public vehicle, the open vehicle, the one that was open to everybody, women, slaves, whatever. Whereas the secret Society of Mithras was just if you're connected, mainly if you're in these family lines. And the Senate and the emperors never caught on to that. They never directed any of their wrath against the Mithras. They directed all of their, heat bombs against Christianity, and that's how they did it. It was a two-pronged takeover.
And here we are 1,500 years later or whatever, right? And we're still dealing with this.
Yeah. So there's a lot of evidence that that may have gone on, and that would explain a whole lot about history, such as why all these Western European nobles wanted to go back in the time of the Crusades and start digging around in the region of Jerusalem, and why you have, you know, kind of all kinds of things in history that are hard to explain. So it's not just one group. It's not the church. See, the church can't really be that powerful unless it's also married to political power. Yeah. At least that's what these priests apparently knew. They were like, look, we got to take over the army. We got to get control of the Praetorian Guard. We got to get control of all these things. And so, they said about it very deliberately, but it may not have just been a material side to the story. They may have known some esoteric kung fu as well.
Yeah. We're about our time here. But yeah, I kind of want to hit on just one thing here for just a few minutes, and that is, like, what has this done for your spiritual journey? Like, coming across this, you know?
Yeah. So that's a great question. And this is actually, you know, as I alluded to, this is something that, you know, not too many years ago, I was not going in this direction. So I'm still exploring it. But I did want to get to, you know, we've wandered a long way, maybe not that far, from the zodiac wheel. And the horizontal line is the equinoxes. That's where we're thrown down into the material. The vertical line is the solstices. That's the spiritual line. So we are crossed on this cross of matter. We've got a material component that goes around in kind of a horizontal way, kind of like my dog is horizontal. It's the animal side. That's the horizontal line between the equinoxes. But we've also got a spiritual line. And that's what we're supposed to be raising. In ancient Egypt, there was Osiris was associated with something called the Jed column, the backbone of Osiris. And in some of the myths, it's thrown down. When Set kills Osiris, the Jed is thrown down and Osiris is shown laid out horizontally like a corpse. But then there's these depictions in the Book of the Dead and stuff where Osiris is raised up vertically, the raising of the Jed column. And sometimes at the top, there's two arms reaching up. And sometimes you see an Ankh, which is a cross with an infinity circle on top, right? Yeah. Sometimes the Ankh even has a pair of arms reaching up. There's a very famous drawing in the Book of the Dead and the Papyrus of Ani where the arms are upstretched. At the top of the top of the column, the arms are upstretched. And in yoga, sometimes, you know, there's these postures where the arms are reaching up. That's like raising the Jed column. Yoga is involved with raising the spirit, raising the prana, this inner life vitality, or chi in the martial arts is this inner spiritual side. But the raising up into these upstretched arms, it is associated with the summer solstice where there's Cancer, the crab is there, and Cancer, the constellation, actually has outstretched arms. And that's what I believe the scarab is. I'm getting around to answering your questions. The scarab beetle in ancient Egypt has these upraised, outstretched arms. I believe it's because Cancer, the crab, is at the top of that spiritual part. When you raise the column up vertical, you're re-identifying, you're recognizing the spiritual that's inside the material, and you're raising it up.
And it's almost like the zodiac gives you a template to do it.
And right? The zodiac is reflecting it. It gives you a template to do it. But one thing you said in your interview, which I thought was so amazing, when you talked about the letters of the divine name, and you talked about the Yod, Nun, Resh, Yod being hands and a head reaching up like the birth, right?
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's a spiritual birth. You talked about it. Well, it relates to the Cancer at the top of the zodiac with his arms outstretched. It relates to the scarab at the top of the Jed column with his arms upraised. It relates to that Ankh in the Papyrus of Ani, the version of the Book of the Dead that was buried with a scribe named Ani, a priest named Ani, with its arms raised up. So that's what we're supposed to be doing in this life, is identifying the spiritual. We come down, it's like we're like a metaphor. You know, the Bible is this metaphor that brings heaven down to earth in order to raise us, to elevate us back up. Well, we came down into the material to raise back up into spiritual, mm-hmm. to somehow transcend the material. We have to come into the material for some reason, you know. I think I read just recently on Twitter, someone posted, Alan Watts said, the meaning of life is life. You're doing it right now. By living in this life, you're somehow elevating the spiritual by coming down into the material. I can't explain it, but you're doing it, and we should be trying to do it more by blessing. You know, blessing is calling forth the spirit side of this material. When you bless something, you're recognizing, I got this from one of the books by Sandra Ingerman, who is a shamanic practitioner who does shamanic drumming, and she's written a lot of great books, and she always talks about blessing. And to me, blessing is connecting with that spirit world, perceiving the spirit in something. Even if it's your food, you're perceiving, well, the spirit of the animal gave this to me. Like the, you know, the American Indians, when they killed a deer, would say thank you to the spirit. Or if it's leaves that you're eating, you know, kale leaves or whatever, you're perceiving the spirit that's behind that, or that's within, that's buried in, there's a spiritual side. Blessing is calling that out. So we should be doing that in our life somehow, paying attention to what we're paying attention to, so we're not cursing. Like, I notice myself, most of the time when I'm cursing, it's because of something to do with the material world. I knocked my coffee cup off the edge of a table and gravity took over and made it spill all over the place. Because I'm living in a material world, I stub my toe, I hit red lights, you know, instead of green lights. I'm in a material world. We've got to be careful not to curse the material world, because actually we're supposed to be blessing. So anyway, how does this relate to my life? I don't know. I'm trying to find ways to connect more with that.
Yeah, it's cool. You know, this kind of brings this whole conversation full circle, because, you know, it's like I feel the same way. It's like, kind of coming into this information, it's like brought me to that same conclusion of lifting myself up out of this material dimension, you know, appreciating the material dimension, because this is the dimension that gives me the opportunity to do such, if you will. So it's like, you know, once again, yeah, two different angles coming to that same circle. So that's really cool that you're saying that. So, David, thanks for the time, man. I really appreciate it. This has been a lot of fun. So, and yeah, let's do it again. Once again, love the book and keep doing what you're doing, and we'll talk in the future, and stay thirsty, my friend.
Hey, thanks so much, Marty. I really appreciate your, you know, spending the time to really delve, or the patience to really get through all of that stuff, and I hope we talk again soon.
Yeah, let's do it for sure. All right, peace.
All right, man. Hey, thanks a lot.
All right, talk to you soon.
Talk to you later, Marty.
You've been listening to the Marty Leeds Mathemagical Radio Hour. More information about the work of Marty Leeds can be found at MartyLeeds33.com. You can download his full-length studio record, Opus Medico Musica, from iTunes or Amazon.com. And be sure and check out his books, Pi and the English Alphabet, Volume 1 and 2, and The Peacock's Tales, available at MartyLeeds33.com and Amazon. For hours of free video, check out his YouTube channel at MartyLeeds33. More information about SyncBook Press, SyncBook Radio, or SyncBook Events can be found at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website, and consider setting up a monthly charge. Thanks so much, and though some people think it's a piece of cake, we all know it's easy as pie.